There's some fun statistic about the number of Texas legislators that are from the Houston area is greater than the entire delegation that's from west of the I-35 corridor. And so there's a huge power strength in that urban concentration of elected officials. And so how we keep a focus on balancing not only the needs to provide water to urban areas, but also to maintain water in our streams for the environment, to maintain water in our rural communities for rural working lands, is an important conversation.
Thank you, Catherine.
Yeah.
So Marissa, I couldn't help but hear, as Robert was talking about San Antonio water systems, that a lot of what they've done from an investment standpoint is diversifying their water portfolio. And it seems like that's been a big focus for Austin as well when it thinks about its resiliency. So I wondered if you would just briefly tell us a little bit more about the general approach to thinking about resiliency, and then how it is that you included stakeholders in the process of determining that as well.
So overall, our approach to the plan was guided by several guiding principles that we laid out with our task force and with our community. And I mention that because one of our key guiding principles was, of course, maintaining public health and safety, but also focusing on local water supplies, or water supplies that we would have more local control over. We are, of course, the beneficiaries of a wonderful shared resource in the Colorado River and Highland Lake supply, and it was important for us to be able to strengthen our sources of supply by having something like an aquifer storage and recovery facility that we would have local control over, to be able to take water from our excess water rights, for example, to the Colorado River, store that in an ASR, and be able to pull that out during drought times. And that would be something that the city of Austin could access itself. And then we also wanted to build on our history of strong conservation and build our reuse portfolio. So in terms of conservation, tightening up leaky pipes within our water distribution system, implementing advanced metering infrastructure, smart meters to apprise customers of their own water usage patterns, potentially alert them to leaks or anomalous usage, making landscapes more efficient and climate appropriate for Central Texas. And then in terms of diversifying our reuse portfolio, we came at that through two approaches. Our centralized reclaimed water system, building out that centralized reclaimed water system, and connecting more customers to that to be able to use that for not only outdoor irrigation, but also for indoor non-potable purposes like toilet flushing or cooling. We have another strategy within the plan to incorporate decentralized reuse. So that could be at multiple scales as well. That could be at the on-site scale where all of the gray water in a building, for example, could be captured, treated, and then reused to meet either outdoor irrigation or indoor non-potable purposes. So that could be for an individual building, or we could have district scale applications for a grouping of buildings or potentially for an entire neighborhood. And that's important because we are in effect creating a hybrid water system. We're creating a hybrid water system that makes the maximum use of all of the water supplies that are afforded to us. So that approach of kind of understanding the city, somebody mentioned before to me a phrase called an urban metabolism, understanding how the metabolism of a city works in terms of how buildings use water as well as how the city as a whole uses water was important to us. And you can understand that this creates very complicated and complex feedback loops within the city, and then we're already thinking about how that creates feedback loops within our use of our shared resources in the Colorado River supplies. It was an important facet for us to make sure that we're being good neighbors as we implement this plan, as we move forward with this plan, and make sure that we involve stakeholders not only from within the city of Austin, but also from other communities that could be affected by implementation of the strategies. In the development of the plan, we did a lot of stakeholder outreach, a lot of community meetings. We learned that it's not enough to hold workshops and expect people to come from us. It's not even enough to hold workshops and put them online and expect them to tune in. We learned that we had to go out to where people were already. So we went to tons of neighborhood meetings, community group meetings, community events, all to try to either give presentations or have conversations with people about the planning that we were doing. And we tracked the data from the different outreach that we did to try to understand where are we going and who are we meeting when we go to these places. What are the demographics, age, race, gender, where do people live? Do they live mainly in single family homes or multifamily residential? Income, education level, and as we were tracking all of this data, we were able to try and figure out, okay, we're seeing some gaps in certain areas. For example, we're not getting as much participation from lower income folks, people living in multifamily residential, people of color, and so we would try to target our outreach events to be able to try to gain additional stakeholder input from those folks. That was a really important component for us, and it's also kind of a pilot project, if you will, for Austin Water. It's helped to influence, I think, a lot of what we do now and how we're thinking about how we engage stakeholders in the future.
Thank you so much. I just took a very valuable lesson to go out to where people already are, because sometimes you find yourself listening and you're like, where is everybody? What I'd like to do is just close by asking each of the panelists, and I'm gonna hear this next question to Robert, if you want to pass the microphone there, to talk about opportunities and challenges and kind of tie this together from a practical standpoint about, you know, you've seen the landscape, you've heard about their approaches to resiliency, you've heard a little bit about how they involve stakeholders. What do you see as the biggest challenge and opportunity as you think about resiliency in San Antonio, and also as you think about how to involve appropriate stakeholders so that equity and resiliency is all reflected?
For the San Antonio water system, you know, this is a system that provides water and wastewater to almost 2 million people. It's really a day-to-day, doing your job kind of thing that we have to worry about. That's what we keep people up at night. And so one of the things is, to some extent, I want those customers to take this for granted, to not think about San Antonio water system, not to have to think about when you turn on the water, is plentiful, affordable, quality water going to come out? And when you flush the toilet, it's gone. You don't have to worry about that. You don't want to worry about anything at all. And then on the other side, please recognize how much is involved in getting those two simple things done. I do want you to appreciate what we do and the cost of that. Recently, we had a press conference, and the reason there was a press conference is because it was controversial with a military base. We have, we're called Military USA, so we have a whole lot of military presence in San Antonio. And we had a sewer line going through through the base. It was our sewer line. But it was capacity issues, had to be a much bigger pipeline. And of course, there was always issues going through an Air Force base. And if you remember in the 1950s and 60s, people didn't care, you just buried it, whatever it was, you buried it. And so they didn't want us digging up that sewer line to put a new sewer line in. But it finally got resolved. For the first time in my life, I can actually say this, and it's true. It took an act of Congress. We had to get legislation passed to resolve this issue. But it was a $200 million project, $200 million. If you have a $200 million project, you want to have a ribbon cutting. You want to have school children come visit it throughout the years and know about it. But for us, that's what the big challenge is, and that's what we see is that the public just needs to know that there is an opportunity there for them to have what is a basic necessity of life, plentiful and affordable, but everything involved in that. So the challenges are that. The challenges also are making sure that our growth is met. Part of it can be met through water conservation. We consider that a supply. Part of it can be met by our recycled water system where we're reusing it. Part of it can be met by our underground storage of water. When it's plentiful, you store it, you bank it. But a lot of it cannot be met because we are growing very quickly and very fast. It's going to be very interesting 50 years from now as to whether or not San Antonio was right or Austin was right, because Austin has done a different type of approach. They're doing it very locally. They're mandating a lot of reuse, a lot of reclamation, and maybe that is the answer, because Austin is growing up, San Antonio is still growing out. But for San Antonio today, our water plan is the right plan. 50 years from now, it may not be so. Today, I think Austin's plan is right for Austin. It was not right for us. So there's uniqueness there, and there has to be a respect that what they're doing is different because of their political issues, their different policy issues, quite different from ours, and it doesn't mean that one is right, one is wrong. And even 50 years from now, I don't think you'll see a winner or a loser. You'll just hopefully understand that whatever Austin did, they did, and it was right at the time. Whatever we did, and it was right at the time. But for right now, it's getting additional water supplies because we are growing very fast. We're very blessed that we have 9 different water sources, 13 different projects from those 9 different water sources. For example, the Carrizo Aquifer, we're getting water from the Carrizo Aquifer hundreds of miles. This is an aquifer that goes all the way from the Mexican border to Arkansas. And we're getting water from that aquifer in 3 different places, hundreds of miles apart. The Wilcox Aquifer, which is under the Carrizo, is a brackish aquifer. We're getting water from that. And so those local sources, the Edwards Aquifer, the Trinity Aquifer, have all been either used up in the sense that there's regulatory issues that you can't use anymore, or Mother Nature has taken care of it at certain periods. You cannot use more. Medina River, Medina Lake, that we also use in 2011, shut down because of that drought. We did not get any water from Medina Lake or Medina River. And so all those come into play. And so I think one of the challenges for us, one of the things that we want to, that I want to have people know about, is that there's a big difference between drought responses, water management, and water conservation. Each one of those three has to be uniquely dealt with, has to be integrated with the other two. If you use one to solve the other ones, you make big mistakes. We have one city here, Wichita Falls, that's close to the Oklahoma border, was days away from running out of water in 2011. And they even built a wastewater treatment plant to reuse a total water, to actually reuse it for potable purposes. But it rained, and so they stopped. And that was their response. So water conservation for them was a big problem because it cut into their revenue so much. So as I mentioned, these three things, drought response, water management, the day-to-day thing, and water conservation, you just have to integrate all three into your projects.
Please. Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to note that I really liked your comments about basically your water supply portfolio is context specific. So what works for one city isn't necessarily going to work. It's not a copy and paste on to another city. And it also depends on your stakeholders and on kind of the political environment, like you mentioned, that you have within that city and what that those citizens want to do. And also just want to mention that it is true. I mean, if there's a terrifically bad drought in the future, you know, we're not going to be able to provide potable water to all of the members of our community just because we have a decentralized on-site reuse and we've conserved. You still have to have molecules of water to put through your distribution system to maintain a certain level of pressure within that system so that things are going out rather than coming in. You know, there still has to be a source of supply for that city. And so sometimes I think we do get into this mindset that there is just a select number of strategies for water management strategies that are good and that are beneficial for people and the environment, and we don't look at other strategies that may be necessary for us to actually provide an equitable water future for all the members of our community.
That's perfect. And true resiliency in terms of security. So the grand philosophical closing statement that was back here before was like resiliency for whom and what. I think what's so astounding looking at San Antonio and Austin in this particular context is also the power of choice in it, right? And Texas is very based in the stakeholder process where people get to choose how it is that they are going to allocate their resources. So maybe just some closing comments. That's great. We can zoom out now to the Hill Country as a region and then kind of Texas. And then open up to some questions. From a Hill Country perspective, what would you say are the biggest challenges, opportunities, and particularly as it involves stakeholder engagement?
So I think in the Hill Country, I've talked a little bit about this. The maybe number one biggest challenge, which also creates lots of opportunity, is just the rate of change, the rate at which we're seeing our region transform as we grow, as we anticipate doubling our population over the next 35 years or so. The way that that creates opportunity is we have a really increased awareness that if we don't act now to build in resilience, to build in sustainability into our systems, that we do stand to lose them. And so people are really coming to that awareness and actively seeking innovative solutions. Another big challenge, though, is in working in the rural context. And so the city of Austin, the city of San Antonio are both blessed with fantastic resources, both in terms of financial resources, in terms of staff and the technical knowledge and ability to undertake a process like looking ahead 100 years and planning for resilient water systems. Smaller communities like Junction, like Johnson City, or Blanco, or Burney, are much harder pressed to just respond to the immediate issues that are facing them today, let alone look ahead 100 years and plan for resilience. And so how we engage with those communities that are much more on the level of reacting to day-to-day issues as opposed to proactively planning ahead for resilience is really important. And then one last point I'll just make that, you know, we get so wrapped up in this conversation of growth in Central Texas and the Hill Country that sometimes I worry that we fall into a self-fulfilling prophecy sort of thing, that when you are looking at population projections and looking at the fact that they are going to be scattershot across our unincorporated areas, that sometimes we invest in major infrastructure to prepare for that growth, that ends up accelerating the growth in and of itself. And so roadway projects are a fantastic example of that. We're always looking at highway expansions to alleviate traffic, and particularly in Hays County, for example, sometimes by the very nature of expanding that road, you're making it more desirable for folks to move in. So it's a really difficult game because we need to be preparing for water security, for transportation security, for all of the things that are going to make our community resilient in the face of growth. At the same time, we don't want to prematurely invite that sort of growth and development. And so that may be one closing thought.
Thank you very much. So I'd like to turn to Mary Lou and ask you to maybe reflect the larger challenge of grander themes within Texas, and especially as you look outside of Texas from a funder's perspective, from a researcher's perspective, what do you see as the big challenges or opportunities that we have?
Okay. I offer these almost like thought bubbles of observations as a human being and as a funder, as a Texan, as a mother. I just have a list. So I know Jay knows this, but if you all are putting an NSF proposal together or anything, I would suggest to avoid thinking of cities under some sort of bubble, like they exist like all by themselves or something. They are part of a larger system that includes rural areas. So Catherine talked about the growing population of urban areas, and so representation at state and federal levels of government are going to change and are changing. Rural areas are going to be less and less represented. And yet it's rural areas where urban settlements get their resources. So if you look at some of the cities who have grand visions of being 100% renewable in Texas, which is a fine thing, where are they getting those renewables? They're getting them in perfectly good Chihuahuan Desert, west of the Pecos River, and sometimes on the Pecos River, with $7 billion worth of transmission lines that all Texans paid for and are paying for to ship very inefficiently wind and solar electrons to Houston or Georgetown or Austin, San Antonio, the border, Dallas, Fort Worth. Our perspective at the foundation is if these fine cities want to be 100% renewable, then they ought to put their stinking renewables in their parking lots and on their roofs and leave the Chihuahuan Desert alone. So we call them, so Texas loses more open space to development than any other place in the United States. And now we lose more open space to energy development than any other purpose. So when you think about transmission, pipelines, oil and gas, and renewables, solar and wind, that is your energy infrastructure. And that is to feed the great beast of cities. So I think that you need to avoid thinking about cities as some sort of monolithic, precious, everything else be damned for the sake of the multitude that live in cities. We call, and there are, it's a growing term, I personally love it, but the industry certainly doesn't. West Texas is now being called an extraction colony. That's from the developing countries, but that is what we are treating West Texas as. It is an extraction colony. We are extracting resources. We're growing food and fiber and fuel and to some extent fluids to ship to south and east of I-35. So I invite you all to think about not just resiliency in the cities, but what is that resiliency costing the rest of humanity? I would suggest that you think about end users as stakeholders. User-inspired research, co-created research with people like the good folks here on the panel who are actually going to use research, should take a part in figuring out with you the questions that they need, the science, the gaps in the science and the data and the methodologies that they deal with on a day-to-day basis so that you're answering questions that they need and that they'll use. Some of you all were in a meeting earlier this week, and you know how I go on and on about being a mom of a 14-year-old, and I'm going to say it again. The people who are going to live through this horror that is the 21st century are already alive. My daughter's 14. She's expected to live well over 100. I always enjoy the gasp that I get in the new science that says the first person to live to be 200 has already been born. And the world that they're going to live in is one that they need to currently be involved in defining. So I would say that the young folks and students, I see a couple of young people here, they need to be engaged in your research and they need to be engaged in the world that they are going to have to deal with. I would say the biggest opportunity, in my opinion, for Texas is the fact that we do have these fastest growing counties in the country, that we contribute more to climate change than any other state in the country and one of the top in the world. We will also experience the impacts of climate change more than any other place probably in the world. We have everything but earthquakes, which aren't, as far as we know, climate change driven, although we might have some seismicity events from oil and gas development, but they're just little baby ones. The natural disasters from climate change and the changing in ecosystems caused by human settlement and the cities, we're going to feel those impacts more than anyone else. We also have some of the poorest counties in this country and in the world along our border. It's a shame to me that with the immigration issue and the wall issue, that there is almost no work being done on the Rio Grande or in those counties, both as critique on the wall asking the question of why in this great country we have counties that are basically developing countries along this border. And they're also growing. It's not just Central Texas, but those counties are growing and they need economic growth. They need attention paid to their agricultural sector and why are they growing alfalfa down there and what are they going to do about a sustainable water source as well. And I think that if we were able to figure out, given our role in climate change, the resiliency issues from the impacts, the fact that we have a developing country along our border, and that we're the fastest growing region in the country with resource constraints all over the place, and the largest producer of oil and gas now in the world in West Texas, we've got it all here. And if we could figure out solutions to even just one of those questions and problems and make a model of that, we would be contributing to well-being globally.
Thank you. Well, that's quite the final comment to end on. And I would say that drawing from the panel overall, what I hear is from a resiliency standpoint, it's important to invest in diverse portfolios, to think about equity issues, environmental equity, to think about capacity building within communities, and all of that relates to appropriate stakeholder engagement so that you can set your priorities. And we're very fortunate to have incredible challenges, but also incredible opportunities within Texas, some of the most amazing data collection and conservation efforts, and I think that there's an opportunity to really set new standards. With that, I know that we started over time, but now we are overtime the overtime. So I don't know, I'm going to lead it to the organizers if you'd like any questions to be asked.
Sure, good.
Fantastic. Okay.
I want to ask a more hypothetical question, because everyone's talking about real world stuff. I think one of the ways of finding the problem is how are we accommodating, let's say in Texas we're 20 to 30 million people. Most of what we've been talking about is existing infrastructure and how do we tweak in the various contexts and conditions. So this is a general question to the whole panel. If you can arrange those people in any way that you want, knowing that the resources are where they are, how would you do it? Is there a dispersion model? Do you buy into cities? Do you buy into West Texas, is it, draw a boundary around it and let it be its own sort of ecosystem? What's the best way to accommodate human beings that puts the least strain on the environment?
And perhaps as an add-on, if I may, because I've heard this in terms of existing infrastructure, how do you determine the return on your investment in terms of investing into resiliency? And if you're already paying off, right? Robert talked a lot about the pricing model of existing infrastructure. How do you factor that in? Would any of the panelists like to approach this?
So we talk about this quite a bit at the Hill Country Alliance, what our kind of ideal scenario would be. And we actually partnered with UT's School of Architecture, the Community and Regional Planning program within the School of Architecture, to begin to look at that. What would a regional plan for the Hill Country look like? I think that a couple of the biggest findings were we would love to see more people moving into our urban centers where we can take less reliance on roads and infrastructure and put more on Austin Water and saws to be providing sustainable water supplies for urban infill. To do that, to incentivize folks living in downtowns and walkable areas, we need a much more robust transportation system. Texas doesn't have that today. Part of the findings of this UT study was the need for a high-speed rail system linking Austin and San Antonio so that folks feel like they can live in San Marcos and get to downtown Austin to work and get home without sitting in I-35 traffic. We don't have that today. I think that's a long way off. I think there's a huge need for increased conversation around that. In the rural portions of the Hill Country, we're seeing a lot of dispersed, low-density development that happens right on the fringes of our small municipalities. I would love to see more growth, more economic focus on those main streets of small towns. I would love to see more access to broadband so that folks could live in those rural communities and be able to make a living without having to feel like they need to come to Austin and San Antonio to do that. That conversation is starting in large part thanks to Rural Funders Network, of which the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation is a really strong partner, but includes a lot of other philanthropic entities in Texas. So I think we have some ideas out there, but there's a lot of investment in the infrastructure to make that vision a reality.
I'm always so amused when we talk about just how real getting internet out is in the practicality of data collection, just lolcats for everybody. You had a next question.
Yeah, so building on that and what you were saying before about, you know, when we plan for growth and when we build infrastructure for growth, well, guess what happens, right? And that's certainly, you know, true. It does happen that way. And even as we think of improvements, like what you were saying, the rapid rail, you know, system, which would definitely be better than having people driving and being stuck in traffic, for sure. But at the same time, that also brings these unintended consequences and cascading effects of actually attracting more growth. And the problem is that a lot of the issues that we're dealing with in terms of sustainability are directly related to growth. If growth were not there, we wouldn't have these problems. And so the question here is, and I'm not talking, again, like just to clarify, because I raise this all the time and people get like really edgy about it, like I'm not talking about population control, okay? I'm talking about, you know, consumption and, you know, and pollution that comes. So growth is beneficial up to a certain point. After that point, it starts becoming more costly than beneficial. And that's where we are, right? So the question is, have you considered, and are you projecting or like having some discussions or even considerations of uncoupling this need for growth as a way of economic development, where economic development could mean something different that is not related to growth, but I'm just not seeing that conversation happen. So what are your thoughts on that?
I'll just mention a couple of things because we get this this conversation comes up a lot in like the stakeholder engagement that we do when we go out and we talk to community members at library meetings or things like that. People ask us, why can't we just stop growing? Can we just stop the growth and just and I, you know, I don't know where I would draw the. I would say I don't know where I would draw the line. I got here in 2005. I'm from San Antonio, so.
2006,
yeah.
Maybe?
I guess 2006.
My
husband was born here, but he grew up in the Valley, so does he get a pass? I'm not sure.
Right.
So, you know, we have that conversation quite a bit. And I can definitely understand the value of having conversations about land development patterns and density and trying to make a development as efficient as possible and our use of resources as efficient as possible. But inevitably, these conversations kind of veer into a direction of like, well, we want to make our place nice.
Right.
There's a really good book by this guy, Andrew Bush. It's called A City and a Garden, I think. It's about the city of Austin and about how in order to attract white-collar workers, the city marketed itself as a place with these great environmental resources and green space for recreation. And that kind of policy is evident in kind of protection of certain areas and not protecting other areas. And that shaped a lot of how the city has grown, and it's shaped how we think about certain resources. That's kind of in a microcosm. That's just the city of Austin, but it sounds like we're having that conversation a lot more in general because we want to protect certain natural areas, but then we just want the cities to be kind of these, I think somebody, I don't know, the beasts where we keep population and they just use as little resources as possible so we can protect our natural environment. And I just think there needs to be, maybe that's a topic of research,
yeah.
To understand how do we talk about that and how do we approach those issues in a way that recognizes the value of the environment, but also the value of the people having a good quality of life.
I thought maybe I'd ask Robert, as a, again, you know, responsible for one of the fastest growing cities in the nation, but also as a form, as a policymaker, the narrative around growth in Texas. What are your thoughts on it? Because that's a hard conversation, and it's a deeply Texan
one. It is very hard, I don't see anything wrong with growth. But you're right about when does it stop? When does it reach a tipping point? Growth versus bad growth. I think at SAWS we've been very responsible about growth. And if you know anything about City San Antonio, we're tending to grow northward. And some of the reasons has nothing to do with natural resources or anything like that. It has to do with school districts. The better schools are on the north side than the south side. But there's still some quality south side schools. So one of the things that we did was, it's a public-private agreement again with some engineering companies to help fund a sewage line. And this is how much my life is about sewage. I get to be sometimes, is building a huge sewage line, big enough to drive a truck through, big enough to support a city the size of Corpus Christi, if you know Texas or Waco, to redirect some of that growth. So this was a pipeline on the south side of town to kind of balance it out. So that growth, and it's happening. This was started in 2008, so we're 11 years from now. You can see the growth happening in that part of the south side of San Antonio. So growth in and of itself, to me, is not bad. We do support it. Growth, frankly, is what has allowed San Antonio to brag about its water conservation ethic. And water conservation works when there's growth. Our business model at SAWS is to convince our customers to buy less of our product. And we pay people to buy less of our product. We actually help pay for retrofitting of some buildings to use less water. We help entire school districts change out their toilets. We had one suburban city in South Bear County. Their treatment, wastewater treatment plant was reaching a point where they had to either expand or build a new one. And they asked us for some for advice because they were relatively small, about 4,000 people. 4,000 connections. And we looked at it and we said, all you got to do is change out every toilet in your town. And it'll meet the requirements of the regulatory agency here in Texas about whether or not you have the capacity. And so some of those growth issues, I think, can be handled. It's a question of, to me, suburban growth, which is very taxing on a lot of things, your educational system, your downtowns, your water system. It's very expensive versus growth that is up. San Antonio is probably, I would say, maybe 10 or 15 years behind Austin as far as our growth. Our growth is still happening a whole lot in the suburban parts, but actually it's also happening a whole lot downtown in the urban sectors where we're seeing a lot of growth verticals as opposed to horizontal. But growth is a challenge, and it's one of the things that my job there is to never let anybody run out of water. So water security is imperative. I will be a failure if we don't have that clean, plentiful water in the worst of conditions. So we have to plan for that worst day in August after 4 or 5 years of a drought where our system is really taxed. So growth helps us keep our costs down, keep the engines running. But there is oftentimes a much better way to manage growth. One of the problems we have is we're separate from the city. We don't have any ordinance making power. We don't have any enforcement power. The city itself does. So sometimes we are aligned, sometimes we're not aligned with the city.
So Jay, maybe I'm still looking at the time and assuming people are getting hungry. Would you like to close our last question?
So you guys are each working on really strong issues, just a couple of things we need. There's this opportunity talking about growth that there's going to be 28 million new Texans by 2050, right? They're all going to need a place to live. So growth is going to happen, right? An opportunity now is if we've got the best and the brightest together, the researchers, stakeholders, everybody, to come up with a collective way, and
course, as you said, you're different, but come up with pooling our resources of knowledge, right? You guys communicate, and maybe you're exceptions, right? San Antonio talking to Austin, that's out of necessity, but there's nothing really structured there. I guess what I'm getting at, what do you see as the possibility for regional or statewide ability to bring people together, to set up organization, whether it's like, you know, the IPCC or National Climate Assessment, but doing something like that at a scale of the region of the state, where you can look at the best available data and knowledge of planning, say, what are things we can all implement that would make a benefit now because our cities are going to be double the size by 2050? Is that even a remote possibility? Would that require a legislative mandate? Yes.
If I may take that, the answer is it'll never happen. But I'm sad about it. I live in a state where the most important issue was which bathroom do you use? And that was the theme of the legislative session, not this one, but the one 2 years ago, is restricting the access of a bathroom to certain people. I've often been told, why won't the state fund this water infrastructure issue? Why won't the state fund this? And whatever environmental concern there is, and I say the state of Texas doesn't even fund public education. Why would they do that? So to me, it's all political. It is not something that can change that quickly. But as they say, elections have consequences. And the past election, because I think of that that pressing need of who uses what bathroom, a lot of people lost, new people won, and the ones that that came in were able to, I think, put some of the issues in perspective. But the people that barely won and are back in office, they didn't want to go through that again. They liked being in office, so they had the consequence of having the fear put in them of they're going to lose if they keep on this this track. And so we finally funded education to some extent. We finally did some of these things that we should be doing as a state. But what we also do, for example, Austin had a tree ordinance that the governor, I don't know what he did, Austin cut his tree down, one of his trees down, and retaliated against San Antonio's tree ordinance. That's the state we live in. So I'm with you, I want to be with you, I want to advocate for it, but I live in a very ancient thinking state.
Is it good until we educate the public and they vote the right people in?
Exactly. Elections have consequences.
Yeah.
So stakeholder engagement, really important.
I'll provide a slightly more optimistic view. But I agree wholeheartedly that in current political conditions, it's incredibly difficult. And I was just having a conversation with a former Hill Country Alliance board member who works very closely with the legislature, who was commenting on the taxing cap that was put in place with this most recent legislative session. We put a cap on the ability of cities and counties to raise their tax rates to keep pace with growth. And we were talking about the dire consequences that's going to have for particularly rural communities who are resource poor now and will only become more resource poor. But I will say that in the nonprofit world, in the Hill Country, we are doing exactly that. Thanks to, again, funding from the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation that looked at the landscape of nonprofits working in Central Texas and found more than 150 different organizations working on land and water and wildlife conservation, we kind of had a wake-up call to say we need to be collaborating, we need to be communicating more effectively, and working from the same strategic plan towards how we change the business as usual growth that we've been seeing for our state's history. And so the Texas Hill Country Conservation Network, which was kind of mentioned at the very beginning, is exactly that, an initiative to bring together. We now have 50 organizations that are participating in the network. It's allowed us to scale our ambition and scale our drive and scale our ability to fund conservation work in Central Texas. And the next step step, I think, is going to be seeding those other conversations that have to happen. It's great to have the nonprofit community working together. It would be even better to get the metro planning organizations, both for both City of San Antonio and Austin, working together. A portion of the Hill Country actually goes up to the San Angelo Metro Planning Organization, so getting a more holistic look at our region and what tools are needed, bringing in academic voices and policy voices, is the next step. So I'm optimistic that that's happening.
So on that note, let's end with a note of optimism to help us stomach our lunches. Join me in thanking this really incredible panel.
Thank you, Sarah and panel. I'm sure at least some of the panel will be able to stick around and have lunch with us and continue this conversation. So lunch is right over here. Why don't we take a half hour for lunch to start?
And don't forget to put your little hash mark by.
Right.
Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right. Right.